Hi, and welcome to She's the Boss Chats. I'm your host, Jules Brooke, and in the show, I interview amazing women and female founders about what it is that they're doing and why they're doing it. It's all about us lifting up the women around us. Sarah Prime, I am so excited to have you on She's the Boss Chats. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Oh, it's my great pleasure, Jules. I'm really excited about catching up today.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And I can't wait for everyone to hear all about you. So I'm going to go straight in and say, why don't you tell everybody what it is that you're doing these days?
Oh, gosh. I was just having this conversation with someone the other day. It's one of the hardest questions to answer. I guess in a nutshell,
I'm a person.
Yeah, I'm a person who is on a mission to empower people in rural communities to recognise their capacity to affect positive change so that no rural community reaches a tipping point of no return. That happens to be a skill that translates to non-rural communities, to corporations, to schools, to sporting clubs, to all sorts of places. But fundamentally, I'm a person who works in the area of rural contraction, decline and exodus, and a champion of change for revitalising those communities. So anything that it takes to make that happen,
Blimey.
That's what I do.
That is a mouthful. But what is the name of your actual business? Because it's got a name, your campaign, hasn't it?
It does. So the social enterprise that I deliver these programs and events through is called Champions Academy.
We have
schools, sporting clubs. We have community programs, next-gen programs and events as well. And I also have a project called the Global Rural Community Project, which is a separate entity to the Champions Academy, which is all about creating an open source market for solutions to common rural problems so that we can get as many communities as possible turning a corner and never reaching that tipping point of no return, trying to help them to move towards, an era of prosperity again.
You are amazing. I just have to say I love what you're doing and I love that you're making that change, and I'm sure any of my rural listeners are going to love it as well. So talk to me about why you set it up.
Yeah, well, I guess there's a long version of the story and a short one. The short one goes that I was raised in a rural area, grew up on a family farm, and we had to leave when I was quite young and move into town because of, you know, economic conditions at the time. It just wasn't viable to farm anymore. But despite all of the hardship, I remember that being one of the most incredibly vibrant and happy times in my family's life. Fast forward, you know, 20 or 30 years, I've had a corporate career, I've lived up in the Kimberleys, I've gone away and studied behavioural science at uni and done lots of different things.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm going to make you tell us all of those in a minute, but keep going because I love this.
Well, I got to a point in my corporate career where it was really grinding it out, you know, and I was putting my body through a lot just to be able to turn up, front up to work every day and do the job. And eventually I decided that life was actually harming me and not one that was helping me to fulfill my passion. I was simply doing things because I was good at them or because people presented me with an opportunity. And I thought, you know, who am I without this job title or without this 13-year relationship that I was in? Who even is Sarah? Who even is she? What does she care about? And I made the choice to walk away from my material gain and wealth and title and whatever else I had accumulated and worked so hard for, and to go back to that place where I felt a sense of attachment, a sense of belonging, a sense of community back down in the peninsula in South Australia.
So do you think you were burnt out from the corporate life that you'd been sort of, you know, pushing yourself
completely.
And pushing yourself through? And
I'm pretty sure.
No, go on.
Yeah. I was going to say, I'm pretty sure it's certainly not a situation that's unique to me. Many of your listeners might have been through the same. But when you rise up the corporate ladder reasonably quickly and you make a position of, you know, CEO or something equivalent quite young, you have this eternal imposter syndrome, which just drives you to these extraordinary lengths. And I'm often heard to describe the moment as, you know, fearing that the world might stop turning if you dare to sleep. You know,
yeah,
someone
right.
might discover if you that you don't have
sleep.
All of the answers.
Oh,
yeah.
My
oh,
goodness.
Gosh, I'd work until 2 a.m. Just that was when I was productive. That's when it was quiet. The phones weren't ringing. And I would forget to eat for days at a time just because it was such an inconvenience to have to stop what I was doing. And so you would pick at things when you were at, you know, business events and whatnot, but basically just live on coffee or packets
of
chips.
Oh, my goodness. Right. So you sort of
little wonder that
wall.
I got sick, really.
Yeah. So you hit this wall and you thought, I have to go get away. And where do I think
I
of?
Did.
I'm going to – I remember this beautiful place that I used to go to as a child. So you headed back down. For what was it just going to be for, were you taking a month off? I mean, had you, what was the
I
plan?
I had this marvellous plan in my mind, very Thelma and Louise. I bought myself one of those big old Land Rover Defenders because it was what we had when we were growing up and it was going to be my adventure car. I was going to make a beeline down the centre of Australia. I was going to go back to Eyre Peninsula, have a month's R&R, long walks on the beach, you know, write in my journal, rediscover Sarah. Remember what it felt like
to be fabulous.
Happy and healthy and completely at peace. So Port Neal in Eyre Peninsula, that was where it was at. And I did, I rediscovered that feeling of home. But what also happened at that time was I had a terrible car accident and was stranded there. I mean, worst places in the world to be stranded. But, you know, I'd just begun this new fork in the road adventure and all of a sudden here I was in Port Neal without any wheels, without any family or close friends around me, and
were you injured
away
in the car?
Everything.
I was going to say, were you injured in the car accident,
no.
or it was just that your car was written off? In which case, it sounds like the universe was trying to make you learn something.
It was like fate just sort of gave me a big slap in the face and went, "This way, stupid." You know, I've been trying to tell you, I've been trying to give you all these signs, but this is where you belong. But no, it was quite interesting because, as you alluded to, I did completely burn out. You know, some might say it was a nervous breakdown. Some might say it was burnout. Some might say that I was, you know, I was completely incapacitated in terms of workflow and thought processes and everything else. So when I was having that, you know, crystallizing moment where you're having the accident and everything slows down and your life flashes before your eyes, I have this vivid memory of my all that I had left with that was in my, you know, my worldly belongings in my car flying past my head and hitting the windscreen in front of me, not knowing which way it was up and which way it was down. And I remember thinking to myself, if this is my end, I'm at peace with that. And right. I just gripped onto the steering wheel with my hands and, yeah, I took my feet off the pedals and just let things take their course because, I mean, you can't brake in the middle of an accident and expect it to do anything anyway. So I just sort of gripped on. And when I opened my eyes and my vehicle was sitting upright but in trees and I didn't have whiplash, I didn't have a scratch on me, not a bruise, I just sort of thought, oh, well, that turned out okay, you know. And luckily I had been following a friend on this dirt road and so I just rang them. I said, I think I've just rolled my car. Can you come back and help me?
Yeah.
So they came back and towed me out and, and it was just a matter of time getting the vehicle fixed. And, of course, having been through what I had just gone through in Cairns, while I was in Port Neal, I wasn't looking to start anything new. I was looking to just, you know, focus on my health
Chill
and
out.
Happiness.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, of course, what happened was I met and fell in love with a local farmer and never left. And now we're married with 2 kids living in this tiny little rural community called Warminda. And rural communities rock. So
yeah, they do. They
that's
do.
What I'm all
I think
about.
Any of us city folks, when we go out to rural areas, think about that. But was there a light bulb moment? Was there something that actually happened during the course of all of this and before you settled down that made you just go, I'm not going to go back to work, actually. I'm going to do something different. How did that all pan out?
Well, it's quite funny, actually, because when I met my now husband, I had this grand vision that I was going to continue on my merry journey around the Great Ocean Coast and Ocean Road and up the East Coast to Yamba in New South Wales.
Right.
And that was where I was going to base myself until I figured out what I was going to do next. And he had already a trip with his guy mates from uni or whatever planned to go to Central America for ages. And so it was never supposed to, you know, work out on paper.
Right.
But, but what did happen was, you know, fate took its course and I never left. And when he came back, he said, "Thank God you never left. I've not done anything except think about you the whole time I went. And I wished that I hadn't gone."
Goosebumps. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was the moment when we decided, you know, that we were going to settle down here. But what's really interesting is I decided to go back to where I'd grown up. I had this nostalgic picture in my mind that, you know, I knew things had changed. I knew there'd been a recession. I knew that, you know, with all of the developments in agriculture and technology, farms had gotten bigger but less reliant on human labour, and that people had left town because, you know, there were no job opportunities in those industries for those people. And as they left, you know, they took their families with them and schools just got smaller until they closed and, you know, there was no longer hospitals or doctors in those towns. Eventually general stores closed, all that sort of thing. So I knew those things had happened. But when I drove back there on that particular day with a different lens on, a lens that said, "Sarah, you're now living back in Eyre Peninsula. You're not just visiting. You're not just passing through town." Yeah. And I drove past that general store that had the smashed window that was gaffer taped up and the facade of the building cracked and peeling. And I drove past the empty homes that just had weeds as high as me in the front yard. And, you know, the house that I'd grown up in just looked completely deserted. I drove to where I'd done my primary schooling and the buildings were literally gone. And then I drove out to where the sporting community was, which was, you know, a place where kids just don't turn up to play sport and families don't just go to socialize. It's the place where you learn how to be an active contributor to your community. It's a value system of volunteerism that grows from this common ground of sport. And there's this really strong sense of mateship. It's like the beating pulse of a community.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a bit like the heart, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. And when I got out there and I saw that, you know, this place that had these vibrant sporting teams no longer had footy and netball teams to represent it anymore, and I was standing there next to where the torn AstroTurf on the netball court was just flapping in the wind, I felt like it had been, you know, I was just massive gut punch. You know, it took the wind out of me. And I just remember thinking to myself, you know, what legacy can be passed on from here? Because anyone who's born in the current era will never know how amazing this community
was.
And who's going to teach them if there's no one here anymore? And as I drove back to the farm that day where we live now, I went through the communities of Kaiopa and Rudau, then Verran and then Warminda, and I saw the exact same pattern. I saw these crumbling, peeling grain silos. I saw derelict town halls and bare patches of ground where schools were.
Were people living there still? I mean, were there a few houses that were still with people living in them? And if so, what do those people do?
Yeah, I mean, some of these communities still have people living in them, and certainly there are farming districts with families around them. And it's just that the local commerce and trade doesn't exist anymore. You know, there might be
it's
a couple of small businesses that people run. They might be earth moving or something like that where they need that kind of space to be able to park up all their machinery.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just don't have the local general store and the post office and the school.
So where do you go?
And the doctor
if you haven't got that, do you have to just
commute?
Travel for miles?
You do.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely nothing for a family to have to travel a minimum of 2-hour turnaround to go and play a game of footy now or to go and see a doctor or to go and do their grocery shopping. And they don't think anything of it because that's just what they have to do. They don't have another option. So it really is something that I saw through a new lens and I thought, well, if I'm going to base myself here and I'm going to raise my children with the same upbringing that I had, what future am I giving them? And it was at that moment that I really felt that sense of urgency to do something about it and to use the skills that I had acquired in my corporate career, which might not have felt adequate at the time, but I realised were transferable. If I could empower other people with what I'd learned on my journey, I might just be able to help them to do something to turn their community around or prevent it from reaching that tipping point of no return.
Amazing.
And Champions Academy was born.
Amazing. So tell me exactly what Champions Academy does to actually bring life back to these towns. And then I'm going to wind you right the way back to when you were a little girl and find out how in heaven's name you got here. But first, just tell me what exactly Champions Academy does to help these people.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So it's, you think of it like a mentoring framework where you connect people with a mentor that assists them through a learning process, and really it's more a personal development and mission of self-discovery. But you're teaching them the importance of acquiring information from the generation that went before them, before the need for that information is vital, before we're relying on it. You know, we want to make sure that the legacy that that person understands of this town is passed on. But when we learn it, it's our responsibility to then turn around and teach it to someone else. So Champions Academy gets together a group of individuals. It teaches them about the importance of seeking out role models, of behaving like role models, teaches them how to reinvest in the value system of volunteerism. So say, for example, in a Champions Academy sporting club program, we would do that by bringing in the people that currently run the club. How does the treasurer do their job? How does the catering convener do their job? What does it take to be a coach or an umpire or a grounds person? Get to know these people and the hours that they put in, because if they didn't turn up and do their job, the doors to this club wouldn't open on a weekend. Yep. And it takes a lot more than kicking around a pigskin for a club to run. It's not just about playing the game. It's more than a game.
So you're basically kind of teaching them how to rejuvenate their club or even start a club. Right.
Yeah. Love well, it. We used clubs as an example, as an inroad, because it is actually one of the last remaining incubators of leadership that everyday people have access to. But interestingly, it's also one of the only reliable lead indicators of community health and well-being, because I think there's a great quote from The Conversation. A man named Jonathan West wrote an article about it a few years back, talking about the connection of club and community. And there was a lot of research done, particularly in Victoria, I believe, about how a club's performance pretty much determined or was a lead indicator of what the town's performance was. Because when a club could no longer field and finance a team, that community was already on the slippery slope to extinction.
On its knees, and that
is absolutely crippling, you know. And so when a club closes its doors, it's like a domino effect.
Yeah. So talk to me though about money. I mean, how do they, even if you're running as a volunteer, you still need uniforms, you still need the balls, you still need to pay the electricity bill for the lights to be on at night, et cetera, et cetera. So if you've got a really small town that's kind of dying, and certainly I did a drive from Melbourne to Noosa and back last year, and I'm telling you, there were loads of rural communities that were, you know, whole town shopping strips where there may be only two shops open and, you know, the pub only opens at night on Fridays and Saturdays, that kind of thing. How do you then bring everyone back? How do you start to build that community and make it a place that other people want to live without money?
Exactly. That is the question that they're asking. And, you know, you mentioned about money. Well, the small businesses that are there, if you think about what you understand the concept of sponsorship to be.
Yes.
Local businesses in small country towns don't sponsor clubs because they expect something out of them. It's not because they're going to get amazing exposure and be seen as these altruistic companies. They do it out of a sense of duty because they know that club cannot buy Guernseys if they don't have, you know, the $500 sponsorship or, you know, the budget isn't photocopied.
So does part of the Champions
insurance company.
So does part of the Champions Academy teach those people how to go and find a sponsor? And also, presumably, as you've got people in there who may own businesses in town, also tell them, you know, the importance and the value of having, of being a sponsor?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that we do. We make sure that they understand the value of the sponsors, what they're giving up, and the need to return value to them. It's not just a given. You shouldn't be expecting that this is an obligation from them to you. You need to create value back to them however you can do that, and it might not be in the conventional sense. But what we also do, and this is the same across all of our Champions Academy programs, regardless of who they're delivered through, we teach people how to go problem hunting. And by that, I mean, if you can think and behave like a problem hunter, you get at the front of a trend before it happens. You can find a solution for something that you can then innovate and entrepreneurialize, and all of a sudden you have a new revenue stream. So in the sense of sporting clubs, we might teach people that there are ways that you can enterprise your ideas. They might all be small ideas, but they can create different revenue streams that aren't just membership and subs that aren't just sponsorship. Yep. You know, you might find that there are different ways to do things, because let's face it, the way we're doing things at the moment, well, it ain't working that well for us.
It ain't working,
we
exactly.
We do need to adapt and change. Yeah. Cool. And so we just teach people how to notice the changing conditions around them and to do something with that.
That is amazing. How many people, how big is it? I was going to go, how many people, how many towns, but you tell me, how big is it? Well, how long have you been doing it for as well?
Yeah, I launched the idea in 2015 through Ports Football and Netball Club down here in Eyre Peninsula. And that initial program, the sporting club program, has now had about 63 graduates through it. So these are people who have done 2 years worth of personal development and come out the other side. There have been literally thousands of people at our events, at our It's More Than a Game events and super clinics. There have been 2 years worth of school programs now. And we've had dozens of classes through those from year 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, and 10. We've run next gen events with 18 schools.
Well, they are next gen events, aren't they?
10 different LGAs. Yeah.
If you can get into the schools, you know, you're getting the children to be thinking about that moving forward. Oh, I just love the way your brain thinks. So now let me ask you the big question, which is.
Sure.
Tell me how this all happened. Can you take me through your career today, till today? So, because I'm guessing that when you were a little girl on the...
What on earth does one do to end up here?
Exactly. Because I always feel that for the women listening, that they, it's all well and good to say, this is what I'm doing and I'm achieving, but they want to know how it happened and how you've ended up, you know, with the skills to know what to do. So go on, take me right the way back to leaving or the Eyre Peninsula and on from there.
Yeah, well... Leaving Eyre Peninsula and leaving high school, we were living in a town called Kimber by this point, and my only desire was to leave. I'd been plotting my exit because I couldn't live in Dart Peak or on the farm. I didn't want to be anywhere. And
I think that's very common for a lot of young women, isn't it, that they want to leave the city and then when you get older you go, I want my children to have what I had.
Exactly. That's pretty much it. Yeah. But I went away to Flinders Uni in Adelaide thinking, and this is before it was TV shows and things like that, I was going to study criminals. I wanted to learn how to identify in people what makes a switch flick in their head. What makes them
interesting.
Apparently normal, and then all of a sudden have this complete change in demeanor and behavior and thought processes. Or were they always like it? And if so, why? And so I went and I studied behavioral science. But what I discovered was that I was pretty crap at uni. Right. I wasn't failing, but I just wasn't academic. And although I did
Did you make
okay
lots of great
school,
friends and have a great
really,
experience?
No.
Oh,
no.
That's a pity.
I was always out watching bands play, and I was that person who was getting around the live music scene and going to 50 Cent beer nights and all those sorts of things. I was probably pretty undesirable.
That's what uni's about for me.
Exactly. And so I realized after 2 years, look, Sarah, if you're ever going to make a career of this dream that you have, because there was no degree for it at that time, there was no such thing as criminology degree. I realized that if I was going to forge a career here, I would need to join the police force and then somehow join the federal police. And I had no intention or desire where that was concerned. And so I did what you would naturally do in that situation. I quit uni and I became a bartender. And so I worked at a little local pub on West Terrace in Adelaide for about 2.5 years. I did I went to a grooming deportment school with Tanya Powell Modelling Agency, and I learned a few really valuable life skills there. One of them was how not to become a model. So I'm a failed model as well.
I can only tell you that my mother had the same idea and sent me to some finishing school in Melbourne. And all I remember is being taught how to get out of a sports car, a low sports car in a short skirt. and the art of conversation, which I have never, ever had any problem with. So I hear
you. Well, see, I'm the opposite.
You're doing very well then.
I learned. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I learned how to take better care of myself, you could say. I learned how to present myself well and to do things with a bit more dignity. Thank God someone taught me. And my parents, you know, looking back, had been trying to teach me that already. It's just when you hear it from someone else, you know.
Oh, I know.
Oh, it's a light bulb moment.
We now. Don't listen to our parents so because we know better when
exactly,
you're that age.
Exactly. Yes. And I'm sure that karma is just going to, you know, really
bite you on the ass. I reckon it will.
Yeah. What did I do next? Oh, that's right. I worked for ANZ for a while. And then I met and fell in love with a ringer from the Top End, and I went and lived up in Kununurra for a couple of years, and we worked in his dad's company. Now, they used to own a cattle station up there, but it was resumed under the Keep River National Park and the Ord River Valley scheme. And so when we went up there, it wasn't to live on the cattle station, but his dad had this job network contract for matching people to jobs and the long-term unemployed. And so I went from being the company bookkeeper to running the employee leasing, you know, backpackers who would go and work out in the fruit farms, to eventually managing the company by the end of the second year.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, well, if I'm gonna, you know, do this, I should probably get the piece of paper to say that I'm capable of doing it, because we decided we were going to head over east to Cairns by this point, make a beeline across the Top End. And so I registered for a degree in accounting online, and I went and knocked on the biggest doors in town until I got a job. And I started as an auditor, corporate governance auditor, at an accounting firm.
Wow.
I did that for about 3 years. That's, and then I
good job.
It was an incredible learning ground. I will always
was it? Tell me a little bit about it. Why was it so good? And did you have good bosses? Because often that makes a big difference too.
Yeah, it does. But I think it was more the lifestyle of an auditor. It's very different to what you might think, because corporate governance audit is not like tax auditing. Yes, it's the tick and flick, and you know, substantiating what's in a balance sheet and P&L, but my job involved traveling around to all different, you know, island councils and all up around the Cape to different non-profits and things like that, and NGOs doing internal controls audits, looking at systems that were in place, and helping people to reduce inherent risk of, you know, things happening with public money that shouldn't happen with public money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, picture little two-seater planes, and we're being flown out to these little island communities like Bamaga or up the Cape to places like, out to Bamaga and Sasha on the Cape and all of these other places in the islands, Boigu Island and Mobiag and all these amazing tiny little places and these tiny little planes. And auditing teams were a lot of fun. They're usually young people. And my manager was quite young. He was, I don't even know if he was 30 yet at the time. And so, yeah, we had a fantastic time. It was basically a little bit like boarding, yeah.
It sounds wonderful, actually, especially the fact that maybe it's just because I'm in freezing cold Melbourne. The thought of being up in Cairns and flying around to islands sounds pretty bloody fabulous.
Well, it was, and I loved it. I got to see a lot of the country and to experience a lot of different communities. And what was particularly valuable about that time was seeing how different businesses did different things, seeing what worked and what didn't, seeing what had big gaping holes in it and what was really well run, seeing what was financially working and what was a complete disaster. And all of these things, if you're smart, you can learn and apply to your own life experience. At the time, I don't think I was smart. At the time, I just thought, oh, I'm really good at this system stuff. I like this. And I was seconded by the business advisory team after a while. I did do a year of tax at that firm as well, but I really loved the special projects business advisory team. And I became a specialist in systems and operations for them, you know, helping people to set up internal controls and software platforms and all that kind of caper.
Sounds disgusting, if I might say. But anyway, I'm glad that you
loved
it.
I see everyone's shutters come down when I talk about that.
I know, I'm just like, ugh. But anyway, I also know that we need people like you as well in order for the world to go round. So what was the next step after that? And what happened with that job?
Well, you know how things happen in 7-year cycles? You sort of get a bit restless. I got to that point where I went, well, I've been with this firm for 7 years now. I'm 28 years old, or I might have been 27. I'm young enough that I can start an entirely new career. I'm not afraid of not climbing this corporate ladder because I don't think I want to become a partner of an accounting and business services firm.
Okay.
So that weekend I was just flipping through the paper and there was a job as an economic development officer with the Peak Economic Development Agency up in Cairns. And I thought, well, those skills are probably quite transferable because it's the same as doing what I was doing in business consulting, but the business is the region. And so I went across there and I did that. And lo and behold, my boss got cancer and had to go away for cancer treatment. And after a short time of working there, I found myself in this acting CEO role that I didn't feel ready for at all.
Right.
I felt like
hence your comment earlier about – yep. Okay.
Yeah. People would discover I was a complete fraud and who was she anyway and what makes her think she can do this job, and you're turning up to your board's meetings
it's
and you're
so
trying
weird.
To
you
tell
should...
them what's going on.
There are just, you know, it's not just that role, I don't think. I think there's a lot of women, particularly if you are pushed up the ladder because people see leadership skills in you or whatever, that you get there and you just feel like you haven't earned it in some weird way, or that someone's going to catch you out somehow and know that you're not real. When actually, I mean, now that I'm older and you're older, you look at it and think, if you did see someone really young who really had potential, you would want to lift them up. But it's so funny, isn't
it,
that you it can really affect you. I mean, I got headhunted by the Herald Sun when I was about 19. Same thing. And they pushed me through to management. And I remember thinking, I don't think I'm ready for this. You know, you just kind of all
it's
feel so much.
Isn't
so
it?
It is. So how did you cope? And how long did you do that role for as CEO?
I couldn't tell you exactly. My boss did come back. He's
okay,
still
good.
Alive and well to this day.
Great.
But I think I stayed in that role with that organization for about 3 years. And then I received a call
done.
One
you
day.
Well done. Stuck it out.
Yeah, thank you. I received a call one day saying that there was this new thing happening. There were going to be these 52 offices of Regional Development Australia established around the country, and it was going to be this joint initiative of state and federal government to set the strategic priorities from the region, and they needed people to work out what the priorities needed to be. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, so we think you should apply for the CEO role. And I said, I'm sorry, what? And they said, no, we've got this ministerially appointed board and we'd like you to apply for the role. It's not a given, you're not getting it, you've got to win the role. But I thought, well, look, what have I got to lose? I'll throw my hat in the ring, not expecting anything of it. I think 24 or something people from around the country applied for the same role that I had thrown my hat in the ring for. But I got it, much to my complete shock and amazement. And it was around this time that the real sickness manifested, I think. I remember I would wake up at night feeling like I was being strangled, you know, clearly having a panic attack. I felt
Sarah.
Like someone had their knees on my chest and their arms around my throat.
Because it's two and things. It's two different things, wanting a job to see whether you can get it just because, you know, why not? Like, I mean, you know, it sounds amazing. Wouldn't it be amazing if I get it? And then getting it and going, oh, my God, what have I done? And did you get that feeling very early on?
I did. Because I remember people speaking to me, you know, if I got up at a Chamber of Commerce event or something like that and gave a speech, I remember someone pulling me aside afterwards and saying, oh, my boss thinks you're going to be the next Anna Bligh. And I thought, oh, God, that I don't need that kind of pressure. I have already put enough on myself. You know, having people ask you if you had political aspirations and if you could see yourself perhaps running for mayor or something like that, and you just think, what have I done? I don't want this. This isn't
right.
me.
Yeah.
And then the other half of you goes, but they think that you can do it. You know, you probably
it's flattering.
Can
of
if you give it a crack.
Is. Yeah.
And then you start finding out when you wake up in the morning fully clothed that something has happened while you've been asleep, you know, and you're a bit confused when that happens. I remember I used to go to bed completely naked and I would wake up in the morning completely clothed. I thought that can't be, you know.
No, that's very weird.
Surely I'm not being abducted by aliens or whatever. And it kept happening until one night I woke up and I was sleepwalking and I remember the dream that I was having. I thought that someone was knocking at the front door and that I would let them down if I didn't go and answer the door. So I'd better get dressed. No matter how tired you are, Sarah, you've got to go and get dressed and open that door. What if they really need you? So it really was a bit of a metaphor for allowing other people's, or my fear of letting other people down, drive me. So it went from being about not being discovered as an imposter to I can't let these people down. They've put their faith in me. And it took for, I had a friend pull me aside and say, Sarah, your clothes are falling off of you. What's going on? You've lost all this weight. I didn't dare tell them my hair had started falling out in chunks and that I had to hold my hands so that they wouldn't shake. Quite often felt like I was going to stumble when I was walking.
Whoa, so you sound like you were teetering on the edge of something massive. I'm so glad that somebody started pointing this out to you.
Yeah, they did. And so I took myself off to the GP and I said, look, it's probably nothing. It's probably just stress related, but I thought I should, you know, get a health check and just make sure it's nothing more sinister. And my doctor, who's just this wonderful, wonderful lady, said to me, look, I'll do broad spectrum testing on you, but I suspect we're not going to find anything evil. I suspect your body is giving you some very serious signs to say, I'm going to start shutting down if you don't start taking care of yourself. She said, so I'm going to take some bloods. We're going to do that. And we're going to do this other test, this K10 test, which is a mental wellbeing test, a scale of depression and anxiety. And when she did it, and it's looking only at what your results are of the last week, just to give you a baseline, and she said, you're actually in the top 2% for suicide risk.
Oh, my God.
And that was a bit of, that was a bit of an interesting find. I did not expect that. I was just so completely numb and so completely detached from everything that I almost didn't care what happened to me anymore. And so I was put on suicide watch and I had to see a counsellor every second day for a while and then every second week and then, you know, it spanned out. But what she said to me on that day when she did that test was, I need you to go home and shut your laptop and switch your phone off and spend the week just resting. Just put your feet up and at the end of the week you can come in and we'll talk through your test results, whatever they are, we'll work it out. And when you come back at the end of the week and we have this meeting, I'm going to give you a letter of leave of absence from your work, because I think you need to let your board know that you need some time to heal. And she said, and when you have that leave of absence, we're going to have another meeting at the end of that month and I'm going to do the same thing. And she said, I'm going to keep this process going every month until you realize that what you are doing is harmful to yourself and that you realize what you need to do to be well. And I think it's time you started questioning whether or not you are leading a life that is being fair to yourself and if this is what you really want, because I can see that you are going to be your own worst enemy in a way that maybe isn't reversible.
What an amazing doctor. I love her. I love her that she recognized it and that she can't stop you. Stop, slow down.
Yeah, I do
too. So how did you feel though through all of that?
Well, I think by the time the mask had come off then, once she had the evidence in front of her that I was forced to look at, I was that far gone that I didn't have tears. I didn't have anything. I just didn't care. I was in a state where I would just sit idly and just stare and not know how long I'd been staring for. It could be minutes or hours. I would just lie and stare, you know, pulled up under the quilt or whatever. And I remember my mum coming to my house and just bundling me up and putting me in the car and taking me away to her place 15 minutes away, her and dad. And I just crawled into the bed there and I slept for about 3 days, I reckon. But you know, I've never let other people help me before. And for her, that was the first moment where she just sort of said, bullshit, Sarah, I'm taking charge. I don't care if you don't want to be wrapped in cotton wool. And she just bundled me up like a child. And and that was when the healing process.
She must have been terrified. Your parents must have been so scared.
Well, Mum in particular was, because she had been trying to make me change for the last 2 years. She had told me at least 2 years before, Sarah, I'm afraid that something serious is going to happen. And I just, oh, Mum, stop it. Stop worrying. I'm fine. You know, this is part of the job, you know. And I just kept brushing her off. I literally said to her once, stop mothering me, would you? And as a mum now, I realise that would have been like a knife in her heart. Sorry, Mum. I love you.
So then was that when you decided to go down to the Eyre Peninsula and all of this was born?
Well, no. When it got to that stage, and I rang my partner at the time and I said, look, I'm not doing so well, because he was a driller and he was away working. He wasn't seeing these things happening. He would come home from work and he would be doing his own recovery. You know, it's very hard on the body what he does. And so I don't think he ever realised, and perhaps I didn't let him understand the full extent what I was going through, but we were probably both on different journeys. And this is a person I still hold in very high regard, understand. I ended up making the decision that I needed to leave for self-preservation. I had to walk away from people that I cared about and, like I said, things that I had worked hard for, and for the first time put myself first. And that nearly killed me, I'll be honest, that seeing other people hurt because of the choice that I had made, the selfish choice that I had made.
Sarah.
It was soul-destroying.
Sarah, after all the things that you have done for other people, disregarding yourself, it's amazing that you felt that way. Because but I guess, you know, when your brain is clouded and you don't know what's going on, it's clouded, you know, but really to think that you were letting people down when actually you were just trying to survive is amazing to me.
Yeah, but anyway. I hadn't grown up yet. I didn't realise that you can't be there for anyone else if you can't look after yourself. If you don't know how to after yourself, what good are you to anyone else? And so that would be something I would say to anyone who's listening right now. Gosh, take care of yourself. Look out for yourself before you worry about anything else, because, you know, you might cease to exist if you don't, and then how can you help anyone?
That's very, very true. God, and to have somebody assess you and go, you're in the top 2% for suicide would be so confronting, because you'd be thinking, I'm not thinking that at all, but, you know, you were obviously so close to it.
Do you know what my ears probably heard at the time? Oh, top 2%. I'm an overachiever.
I mean, I laugh, but I want to cry as well. So talk to me about setting up the Champions Academy. Were there some pivotal moments during that where something went wrong or something didn't turn out the way you thought it would, and you ended up moving direction or learning something from it that you'd be up for sharing?
Oh, for sure. I am an open book when it comes to lessons learned from mistakes made and lessons learned from challenges faced. When I first pitched the concept, picture a football club AGM with mostly farmers in the room, from the age of, say, 21 to 71.
Yep.
Probably about 30-odd people. And when they said, is there any other business, I put my hand up and I said, look, I've written this value proposition for a mentoring framework that I'd like to put to the club. It's about empowering the next generation to stand up and recognise their capability to shape the future of their club and make it more sustainable. And I've given it to the club president to read in advance. Would you be interested in considering this proposal? And they looked at it and asked me a few questions, but they said, Sarah, we have absolutely no idea what you're talking about.
But as you said, value proposition, blah, 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 I thought you probably lost them on that. Just what the hell is that even?
They were probably thinking, what's a netballer doing at the AGM?
There's that too. And then having the nerve to get up and tell us what we should be doing.
But they were very, very open and very warm people, and still are. But they said to me, Sarah, we've got no idea what you're talking about, but if you can find a way to finance it, we'll be your guinea pig. We trust you. You're one of us. We trust you.
Amazing.
And they never, ever, ever didn't back me in a decision that I made or in trying to grow or scale or in trying new things when things didn't work out. You know, I had complete transparency with the central management, treasurer and president the entire time, because they knew why I was trying to help.
Sorry, are they part of the organisation now? Like, do you have a team of people, of volunteers that are helping you do this?
Well, no, yes and no. What I used to do was to bring in different people from different roles in the club all the time to teach us, to show us how they did their job at the club and to impart their lived experience with us as well. And so they've been mentors to the group. But in terms of the team that I work with, I actually now employ 4 graduates of the program and continue each year to grow by about another person per year. But I think
that
what we've got on the books at the moment, we could probably double that team by this time next year. It's just so much demand for the work that we do, and I just get inquiries all the time. It's really a matter of being able to finance it first, which any entrepreneur will tell you, like, where do you find the money to grow when you've got to bankroll it yourself? Sure, the revenue comes later, but if you can't bankroll it, how do you even grow?
We could have a very long conversation about just that, but have you found yourself a sponsor yet? Have you got one now, or is it just all the small businesses? Because you would think that there would be a large government organisation or a large corporate organisation that would love to be getting in at that grassroots level.
Yeah, and if you're out there, give me a call.
Yes, but, if anyone's
initially,
listening.
Little plug. It really came down to what was then the Rural Industries Research and Development Corporation, which is now AgriFutures, the Rural Women's Awards. Right. I rang them up when I got a grant funding newsletter, and I thought, well, you know, I had been banging my head against a brick wall and everyone was shutting me down and saying, oh no, we don't, they thought it was a sporting club program to teach sports, and so they'd say, no, you need to ring, you know, Sport and Rec, or we only fund
classic
buildings.
Entrepreneur's story, you're trying to do something that people that can't even comprehend,
too conceptual. Blue sky. And eventually when I got that newsletter, I thought, oh god, they support women. I'm a woman. Surely I can have a crack at this. And so I did, and I rang and I told them the story of why I was doing what I was doing. And there was this long, awkward pause. And I just thought, here it comes. Here comes the, yeah, it's not really for us. But instead, this amazing woman on the other end of the phone said, you are exactly what we've been waiting for.
Oh,
right, I'm going to email
you
an application right now. And by the way, it closes in half an hour. So quickly just put in whatever you can and send it through to me by 5 o'clock, and we'll get you going through this process. Little did I know that was the Rural Women's Awards. It was not just a bursary to help women get programs off the ground. So a few months later, I received the Rural Women's Award for South Australia. And another six months after that, I was named the Australian Rural Woman of the Year. I won the national award in front of a whole bunch of people at Parliament
Incredible.
House.
Incredible.
7 months pregnant, waddling up on stage to get an award. So
well, you absolutely
that was $10,000. That was $10,000 of state money and $10,000 of federal money that I really used to bankroll the program. And once I'd done the pilot, I commercialised it, and it was a membership-based program.
Yeah, great.
But that's got its own lessons attached to it.
It does. I'm just going through that myself with She's the Boss. So amazing. Now, we have got hardly any time left, so I'm going to jump a couple of other questions. But there's just the fun bits at the end I always love asking. So is there a quirky fact about you that most people don't know that you'd be up for sharing with us?
Well, there is. I was once a singer in a rock band for a couple of years. And there you
Fantastic.
Go. Hard rock, you know. I was all about Baby Animals, Joan Jett, bit of rock set in that era, you know, bit of Janis Joplin.
I wonder if it'll come back. Or maybe you'll have children who will be in a band.
Oh, they are already, you know, putting on their performances, and I am rocking out with them.
Oh,
massive
fantastic.
Air guitars. We make mic stands out of cardboard tubes, and we just like we put on Guns N' Roses film clips and we jam.
That's fantastic. I've got this vision of you in a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere pumping out the music super loud.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now the last two questions. Aerography. The last two questions are super silly, really, because I love my phone.
That's fine.
So I just ask about apps. Are there a couple of apps that you use? Do you use your phone for business? Are there a couple of apps that you'd like to recommend to us? You can't do social media and banking because I'm going to take that as a given.
No. Ooh, I don't spend any time on social media if I can help it, other than
unusual.
To connect with people. Oh, I find it really hard to engage. I don't know why. Right. I think it's because I go into a scroll hole and I realize I'm not actually controlling what I'm doing. I'm just being.
Right.
But the apps on the phone. Mm-hmm. I actually use a phone and an iPad Pro because I've just gotten it and I love it so much I want to have its babies. And my two favorite apps at the moment are OneNote because I can now handwrite all my notes on the iPad instead of carrying around seven different workbooks because I'm a real scribbler.
Oh, is OneNote the thing where you can write with your handwriting and it'll turn it into text?
Oh, you can use that mechanism with anything. You buy the pencil with the iPad. You can use that in heaps of apps. You can use it in Word, whatever.
I didn't know that.
You name it.
Right. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So OneNote. OneNote's a good one.
OneNote is my new notebook app. And the other one that I use constantly is Asana. I love to use Asana to work with, collaborate with, keep on track with projects because my head is a little bit like a sieve and I need that kind of organization that lives outside of me.
I love it. Well, and what about fun? Do you play on your phone at all? Do you play Candy Crush or...
If I have time for play, I probably pick up a book.
Yeah, good girl. That's a much better thing to do.
And I scribble in that too. Must be with the lead pencil taking notes and dog-eared pages.
That's so funny. Sarah, it has just been such a delight interviewing you. Can you tell the listeners, if they want to get hold of you, what's the best way?
Yeah, reach out to me via my website, sarahprime.com. I would love to hear from you. I've got a Facebook page where every Friday I share 20 seconds with Sarah, so feel free to have a laugh at my expense. I'm usually doing something completely stupid I've messed up during the week. But, yeah, jump on the website and connect with me anytime. I'd love to hear from you.
Oh, well, you are just such an inspiration and thank you for what you're doing for rural Australia because somebody needed to do it and it's wonderful that it's you and I'd love to have a crystal ball for 10 years from now, but I think you'll do it.
The
country.
Oh, thank you so much, Jules. I really appreciate that. Hashtag rural communities rock.
They do. Hashtag they do. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jules. Have a great day.
I hope you've enjoyed this She's the Boss chat episode. It was great to have you here. If you want to stay in touch, you might also like some of the other things that we've got going on with She's the Boss. Join us for our free Zoom lunches for female founders that we hold online. The best way to do any of these things really is go to shestheboss.com.au and on there you can register for the lunches and I've also got links to the website. So either way, I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm really enjoying digging down and getting down to the nitty-gritty with these women and I hope you'll join me for the next episode. Mm-hmm.